we have a few other speakers that will be giving this series. And I think that you're going to find it very interesting. This is going to be weekday nights, one night a week, usually Wednesday night, but sometimes other nights of the week. At any rate, now let's get on with the special topic.
Rewrite
chapters in their national histories in order to erase embarrassments, in order to make themselves appear, in retrospect, to be considerably nicer or better than they actually were. The fact that here is a nation which 3,000 years ago commemorated, perpetuated, eternalized a blot on its national historical record is just one of the things that's very difficult to explain. As, for example, it is difficult to explain in a similar vein why the Torah perpetuates such stories as the Mesopotamian origin of Abraham Avinu. You know, given the fact that you all know, I'm sure that you're all acquainted with the very first Rashi in the Torah, in which Rashi asks, why does the Torah begin with the story of creation rather than with the portion that we read only this morning, Achodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, the first mitzvah which was given collectively to the Jewish nation. And Rashi's answer is in order to relate the Torah to the notion of the Jewish presence in the land of Israel. That if the nations of the world, as happens in the forum of the United Nations on numerous occasions, were to accuse the Jewish people of being listim, of being robbers, usurpers, that you took by force of conquest the land which belonged to other people. Right? Given that, one would expect that if the Jewish people had taken a bolder hand in the reporting of their own national history, that they would have portrayed their ancestor, Abraham Avinu, as being a Canaanite. And they would have said, Abraham Avinu was born in the land of Canaan, and originally the land belonged to him, and then was taken away by the Chittian, Chivian, Frisian, Yebusian, Girgashian, Goliath. And therefore we have returned not to usurp a land which belonged to a completely different people, but that we have returned in order to reassert our patrilineal rights to the land that was originally ours. Therefore, it's inconvenient for the cause of Jewish history for the Torah to acknowledge that Abraham Avinu was not a native-born Canaanite, but rather a Mesopotamian immigrant. Therefore, once again, the notion that the Torah perpetuates the story in which the Jews, the ancestors of the Jewish people, are enslaved and humbled and oppressed, is just too inconvenient for it to be described as an historical hoax. But within the context of the historicity of the story of the Exodus, there are indeed numerous actual historical details, some of which seem to lend credibility to the Torah story, others of which appear on the surface to challenge that credibility. But again, as I said, I don't want to deal this evening with the essential historicity of the story of the Exodus, nor even with the question of fixing or determining a date for the Exodus. Did the Exodus occur in the 15th century BCE? Did it occur in the 14th century BCE? I want instead to deal with some of the themes that pertain to Yitzhak Yisrael, themes which are so significant that we repeat them, we reiterate them annually. That is to say, I want to touch on a couple of themes which appear in the Haggadah of the Leil HaSeder, and to see whether we can't utilize both the means and the methods of traditional Torah study, as well as some of the means and methods of modern biblical study, in order to shed some more and some more appropriate light on those issues. Let me begin with one, and you'll get the taste of it. You know that the number 4 is a particularly significant number in the annual commemoration at the Seder of the Korban HaPesach. 4 questions, 4 sons, 4 cups of wine, unless of course you subscribe to the tradition in which there are not 4 cups of wine drunk, but actually 5, then in that case there are actually 5 questions. Because if we go back to the Gemara in Pesachim, which introduces the questions, and we see the different versions which have appeared in Haggadot throughout the centuries, there are in fact not merely 4 but 5 questions. Nobody asks more than 4, But if you combine all the different versions, it turns out that there are not four, but actually five questions. But let's stick to the number four, because I don't want to have to produce a fifth sign. I want to deal with one of the four signs. Echad Chacham, Echad Rasha, Echad Tam, Echad She'edo Yodeha Misha'o. The wise son, the wicked son, the naive son, and the, I don't know what to call it, the immature son. If you recall in the Haggadah, the wicked son asks the following question. Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem? What is this ritual which you are performing? And the Haggadah says, focusing on the word lachem, you, lachem velo lo, that he seems to appear to describe this ritual as one which is performed by others, as opposed to one in which he participates himself. And the Haggadah says, uvapin she'er hotzi et atzmo min haklal, that since he seems to have accepted himself from the general rule, what are the next two words? Kafar bi'arikar. A kofar, a renegade, then an apostate, a kar, a principle, a fundamental notion, that since this son has accepted himself from the ritual, from the Korban Pesach, he has effectively denied God. Question, why is the rejection of Korban Pesach tantamount to a rejection of God? Do we say if someone was mechalel Shabbat, ulefisha chilel et ha-Shabbat kafar b'yivar? Do we say if somebody who doesn't eat kasher, ulefisha achal l'deilotu t'reifo kafar b'yivar? Why does the Haggadah say that this son, by accepting himself from participation in the Korban Pesach, has not merely committed a sin, but that he in fact has kafar ba'ikar, he has rejected God? I like to look at it for a moment from the other side. If rejecting the Korban Pesach constitutes heresy, then it stands to reason that the performance of the Korban Pesach constitutes the opposite, the repudiation of idolatry. In fact, this is basically acknowledged as the principal ingredient of the original and historical Korban Pesach, as Moshe indicates in a reply to Paro. When Paro, upon the conclusion of one of the Makot, which we read last week, tells Moshe, why do you need to go off into the Midbar for 3 days in order to celebrate your festival? Egypt is such a lovely country, why don't you celebrate your festival here? And Moshe's answer is that it would be improper to offer sacrifices to God in the land of Egypt, because, he says, the Egyptians would regard our sacrifices to the Lord as abominations. And he asks rhetorically, could we break an Egyptian taboo, to'avat Mitzrayim, before their very eyes, without getting stoned? Now we know that the Egyptians held shepherds in general, and the eaters of the flesh of sheep and cattle, in the lowest regard. We recall from Sefer Bereshit how Yosef was isolated from the Egyptians at meal time. Because the eating of the flesh of sheep and cattle was regarded by the Egyptians as an abomination. And you may recall that when Joseph was reunited with his brothers, and he's about to introduce them to Pharaoh, he cautions his brothers, he says, let's tell them that we are all shepherds, because then they will give us a separate place to live. Kito avat Mitzrayim kol ra'aitza. Because the Egyptians regard the tending of sheep and cattle as an abomination. Now, what does that make of the Korban Pesach? It means that the Jews knew that they were risking their lives through the sacrifice of the Korban Pesach by taking an animal which was deified by the Egyptians and slaughtering it in full view of the Egyptian population. They knew very well that they were risking their lives. In fact, the Torah goes out of its way to instruct the Jews to treat the Korban Pesach in such a fashion that it increases the risk to them. For example, as we read this morning, they were instructed to set aside the animal which was to be the intended Korban, not merely on the eve of its sacrifice, but 4 days earlier. On the 10th day of Nisan, they already instructed Mishachu u'kichulachem tzor. That meant that for 4 days there was this lamb tied up on the front lawn of all of the Jewish homes in Egypt with a big sign on it saying 4 days to sacrifice, 3 days to sacrifice. It was as it were that they were rubbing the Egyptians' noses in the fact that they were planning on mistreating this object of Egyptian worship. And then when it comes to the circumstances in which the Korban was to be prepared, what are the halachot of the Korban Pesach? The Korban Pesach could not be eaten raw. Uvashel v'gushal b'mayim, neither could the Korban Pesach be cooked, be boiled. Ki im tzli esh. It had to be roasted. To tell you, one of the principal differences between eating something raw or cooking it in a pot and roasting it over an open flame is the question of just from how far away can you smell it. So imagine, not only were they instructed to take this lamb and have it sit on the front lawn for 4 days, but they were instructed that when the time came to slaughter it, they were effectively to cook it, to prepare it in such a way that the Egyptians, even if they would hide their eyes from the abominable sight, could not hide their noses from the smell. Moreover, the pasuk continues and it says, "Rosho al kira'av ve'al kirbo." The animal, when it was put on the spit and roasted over an open flame, had to be a whole animal. The head had to be intact, the hindquarters had to be intact. You couldn't even take this sheep, put it on the spit, and remark to your Egyptian friends as they came by to admire your rotisserie, "Oh, that's not a lamb. It only looks like a lamb, it only smells like a lamb." But it had to be perfectly visible as the lamb that it was. We're still not done. Within every living creature, that part of the essence of every living creature, which in all primitive societies, not even in only primitive societies, but particularly in primitive societies, was regarded as the most important ingredient, that which held the essence of life and that which had the greatest magical or apotropaic value, that is to say, value of serving as a deterrent against evil, was the blood. We know that blood serves as a deterrent against evil. We learned that in Kriyat HaTorah last Shabbat. We learned it from that strange little episode which interrupts the narrative of how Moshe Rabbeinu, after the theophany, after God's revelation of himself at Sinai, left Midian and returned to the land of Israel. Little story occupying only 3 pesukim at the end of Perek Dalet. I'm sorry, it'll be 2 weeks ago. At the end of Perek Dalet in Sefer Shemot. Vayhi baderach b'malon, that on the way with Moshe and his wife and with his child and with his children, vayitbishehu Hashem vayivakesh hamito, that God somehow intercepted Moses' wife and children and sought someone's death. Vatikach Tzipora Tzor Vatikrotet Orat Dena, whereupon Tzipora acted quick-wittedly, and she seized a flint stone, Vatikrotet Orat Dena, and she circumcised her son, Vatagat L'Ragla, and she took the blood of the circumcision, and she touched it to the legs of the child, Vatomer, and she said, Ki Chatan Damim Atale, that you have almost been responsible for a blood letting. A year after then, when then the angel of death seemed to recede, whereupon Tzipora added, Chatan Damim Lamivo, that this act of circumcision could have proved fatal. So we see from that incident the extent to which blood has this apotropaic value. That is to say, the value of serving as a defense against evil. And here, at the performance of the Korban Pesach, the blood served the same purpose. The blood of the Korban was to be smeared on the doorpost. Again, this is part of the attempt to demonstrate how little regard they had and how little fear they had for the sensitivities of the Egyptians. But on the other hand, it was also this value of the blood in warding away evil. Because it was the presence of the blood on the doorpost which kept away the mashlik, which kept the angel of destruction out of the Jewish homes. As a matter of fact, if we look closely, we'll discover that originally the word Pesach, the verb Pasach, doesn't mean to pass over. It's just one of those nice things that we picked up after 400 years of a particularly benevolent galut amongst Anglo-Saxons. The word Pesach, the verb Pasach, originally means to defend. Because God says, U'Pasach Hashem al ha-Pesach, v'lo yiten ha-mashchit la-voil ba-techem l'ingo. That God will perform the act of Pesamachet, vis-à-vis the doorways of the Jewish homes, and will prevent the destruction from entering their homes. So that what act did God perform? One of defense. Come back to the point before which we began. So when the wicked son says, Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem, lachem v'lo lo, on account of the fact that he does not wish to participate in the Korban Pesach, he has demonstrated that not merely is he turning his nose up against some Jewish ritual, but that he is effectively turning, thumbing his nose at a very fundamental Jewish ritual, one at whose heart lies the rejection of idolatry and the confirmation of the commitment to one God. And therefore, someone who would hold that ritual at arm's length is not merely a chotei, in the sense that he's done something wrong. But he is effectively a kofer b'ikar, a heretic. And in fact, this isn't merely an assumption which was made by some of the chachamim in their interpretation. It's borne out, in fact, by all archaeological knowledge of ancient Egypt. The assumption that Egyptians thought that the tending or the eating of the flesh of sheep and cattle was an abomination. That there were particular sheep and cattle which were deified by the Egyptians. All these have been borne out consistently by archaeological researchers. In fact, if we turn our attention for a moment to the Eser Makot, we can see how in the Eser Makot there is an attempt on the part of the God of Israel to do battle, as it were, with those objects which were deified by the Egyptians. We know, for example, that the Nile was deified by the Egyptians. You remember the line that the great Greek historian Herodotus gave us about Egypt. Egypt, he told us, is the gift of the Nile. And the Egyptians, in recognition of the gift, acknowledged the giver as a god. And the Nile was in fact treated by the Egyptians as a god. And it's clear that several of the Makot were aimed at the Nile as a god of the Egyptians. As in fact we know, some recall it from the Haggadah, others may recall it more specifically from the text of the Torah, that God had multiple purposes when he took the Jews out of Egypt. Of which it seems that the purpose of freeing the Jewish people from bondage was not even necessarily the most important one. Because if God's sole or even principal purpose were simply to free the Jews from Egyptian bondage, he wouldn't have wasted 9 plagues. He could have saved them, held on to them, could have used to fuel them later against the Babylonians, and might have spared us the destruction of the first temple. He could have saved some of them to the Greeks, but then we wouldn't have Hanukkah, or he probably might have saved them and used them against the Romans. But instead, plague after plague after plague, whereas it's clear that Makat B'chorot would have been sufficient in and of itself to secure the release of the Jewish people. As Paro, as the Egyptians are described in the parasha we read this morning, Ki amru kulanu metim. The Egyptians genuinely believed that as long as a single Jew remained in their midst, they were all going to die. And under those circumstances, even Pharaoh capitulated and allowed Moshe and Aharon to take the Jewish people out. So if God's only purpose, or even just his principal purpose, were to obtain the release of the Jews from slavery, then God could simply have brought Makat B'chorot, and Pharaoh would have released the Israelites and be done with. But there were other purposes, mutual purposes and simultaneous purposes. One was to bring Pharaoh to the point where he would acknowledge not only the existence of God, but the point at which Pharaoh would acknowledge the participation of God in the historical process. You know that our problem as Jews has not always been with people who don't acknowledge the existence of God. We have a good deal of problems with people who will readily admit that there is a God and that God created the world. But who somehow believe that after God created the world, he kind of stepped back and said, okay, world, now run yourself. And once again, this is a fixture of our benevolent diaspora, because that was the religious philosophy of the founding fathers of the United States of America and to this republic for which it stands. Thomas Jefferson and those around him, Benjamin Franklin and others, were deists. They acknowledged the existence of God and they acknowledged God as the creator of the universe. But they believed that upon creation, God set the world in motion and then left it to the forces of nature to keep the world moving. That's what is ascribed to such ideas as natural law, as natural morality. And that is what enabled them to write such beautiful things as, we view these truths as self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they were endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, amongst which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So our problem isn't only with people who deny the existence of God. The problem at times is with people who will acknowledge the existence of God, but don't really believe that God has anything to do with them, or the way they conduct their lives, or with what goes on in the world. So that along with the purpose of freeing the Jews from the Egyptian bondage, God had the additional purpose of getting Pharaoh to acknowledge his existence. And that's why throughout the story, whenever Moshe comes to Paro, Paro always says, who is this Hashem that I should listen to him and that I should release the Jewish people? He says, I never heard of Hashem, and therefore I'm not going to release the Jews. And therefore, again, the second purpose, the second of God's several mutual purposes, was to bring Pharaoh to the point where he would at least acknowledge the existence of God, but not only acknowledge his existence, but acknowledge God as a vital force in what goes on in the world. Then there was another purpose. That other purpose was to pull the rug out, as it were, from under the Egyptians' beliefs in their many different gods. Uvechol Elohei Mitzrayim Eseh Shefatim. that God devoted himself to the additional purpose of conducting a battle, as it were, with the gods of Egypt. Because the point wasn't only to have Pharaoh acknowledge his existence, the point was to have the Egyptians acknowledge the existence of Hashem, but at the same time to have them withdraw their belief and their support from whatever they acknowledged as being deities. And therefore, just as there were makot, which were aimed at the Nile, because the Nile was regarded as one of the gods of Egypt, there are other makot which were aimed at other objects or items which were deified by the Egyptians. You just have to know, it's not a very difficult thing to do, because one of the things that we know about primitive societies is that they had a tendency to deify almost anything. You know that the phrase that the Torah uses and that the Nevi'im use over and over again in ridicule and idolatry is to refer to it as Eitzim Ba'avanim, sticks and stones. And if you have people who can deify inanimate objects like sticks and stones, then it's not difficult to appreciate that they could very easily deify objects which are animated. And therefore, it's no surprise to discover that along with the Nile, the Egyptians also had a god named Heket, who was a frog. And therefore, whereas at first blush it would seem that the Makah of Sephardea was aimed again at the Nile because it was the source of the frog, it's possible that at the same time it was aimed at frog itself, because it too was an object of veneration, an object of deification in Egypt. Not that we're absolutely sure that Sephardea means frogs. In fact, the only testimony we have of Sephardea being frogs is that's how it's translated into English in the King James Bible. Otherwise, how do we know what Sephardeim are? All we can tell is that these are things that come out of the Nile, and therefore they must be abundant in Egypt. But beyond that, would you say that they are, that frogs, that Sephardea are benevolent? Malevolent, or what? I mean, if we consider the presence of frogs to be a makah, a plague, then one would have to assume that Sephardea was at the least malevolent, and at worst, probably downright dangerous. Otherwise, it doesn't really qualify as a plague. It's more like a nuisance. You know, if you turn all the water in a country into blood so that nobody has water to drink, that's life-threatening. Maybe not imminent fleas, some people can last longer than others, without water, whatever it is. Right? If you release insects which carry disease, if there is a plague of anthrax or smallpox, these are things that are life-threatening. But frogs would seem to be more in the category of a nuisance than an actual plague. And perhaps it's on the basis of this analysis, or perhaps just on the basis of something that he knew personally because he was born and grew up in Egypt, Sa'adia Ba'on, in his Arabic translation of the Torah, translates Sephardea as crocodiles. You can imagine that the plague in which not, you know, I don't know about your children, but I know that one of the children's favorite songs that they say there is the one that goes, frogs, here are frogs, there are frogs, you're jumping in. But if you stop to think about it, a plague in which not frogs hopped out of the Nile, but crocodiles, that already begins to measure up to the standards of the other makot. Okay. This is by way of... Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, not merely a god, but it was the one with which Pharaoh personally identified. That, by the way, was the crocodile regarded as a god. That, by the way, explains why the Haftara last Shabbat was selected from Sefer Yechezkel, in which there is a specific reference, a direct reference to Paro, as a Tamim Agadbo. That Paro indeed viewed himself as being... to argue about whether Tanin is actually a crocodile or whether it's something else, but clearly it's some sort of amphibian, reptilian creature related to the Leviathan. That's why when he gets to Sefer Yishayahu, he has a nevuah for Aharit HaYamin. He says, "Bayoma hu yifkod Hashem b'char bo'ad no'lava ha'kasha," that on that day in the future, the symbol of God's triumph over evil will be the Leviathan Nachash Bariach, that is that serpentine creature, which is that reptilian creature, which is as straight as a bow. Leviathan Nachash Akalato, another kind of reptilian creature, which is crooked. Baharagat Hatamin Asher Bariach. So whether the Tamin is a crocodile or some other form of sea creature, it clearly this too was something with which the Egyptians and particularly Pharaoh identified. In fact, there's even an interesting wordplay that goes along, and that is that at one point, God gives instruction, the following instruction to Moshe. It's in Perek, Shmot Perek, yeah, Zion Pasuk Aleph. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Re'e Netaticha Elohim L'Faro. The hope says, God, I have made you, Moses, an Elohim vis-a-vis Pharaoh. V'aharon Achicha Yihyeh Nevi'echa. Now, on one level, the use of the word Elohim here is merely as a substitute for the principle. A Navi is an agent, and the principal is the one who dispatches the agent. So if the agent is the Navi, then the principal who dispatches the agent is his Elohim. So on one level, it's using the word Elohim in a completely secular sense, as the principal vis-a-vis a Navi who is the agent. But when seen here in the context of Pharaoh, who regarded himself and was so regarded by all the Egyptians as being himself a god, it's a wonderful little wordplay. God is effectively telling Moshe, don't be afraid of Pharaoh. Don't be afraid of this man who has set himself up as a god and is so viewed by this whole civilization. That if Pharaoh sees himself as being on such a high level that he's a god, don't worry, Moshe. I've set you up in such a way that you're an even bigger god than he is. I could be mistaken. It may not be an intentional wordplay. It may just simply be, as I said, the use of Elohim as the principle vis-a-vis Navi who is the agent. But knowing as we do again know from our historical sources, the literary sources, the archaeological sources, that the pharaohs of Egypt set themselves up as gods, I bet that it does indeed have an intentional double meaning. Even if you want, even the pre-miracles, right? Remember that there were two pre-miracles. That is to say, they were pre-otot. There was the snake, and there was the hand that emerged as white as though it were leprous. Now, on one hand, the snake trick is an old one. All the Egyptians knew the snake trick. Hareaya, the magicians, Pharaoh's magicians, were able to do it themselves. I am given to understand that in Egypt today there are still people who know how to do the snake trick. There is apparently a particular kind of snake in Egypt which, when certain nerves on either side of its head are compressed, it turns as rigid as a stick. And that if you know exactly and precisely where to grasp the snake's head, then you can effectively turn the snake into a stick. And you can also understand that, whether as long as you hold it and you keep the nerves compressed, the snake will stay as rigid as a staff, and the moment you throw it down on the ground, the jolt of landing on the ground will send a shock through the snake's nervous system, and it will turn into a snake again. So that in and of itself, the snake trick is an old one. Right? That's why when the Egyptian sorcerers were able to repeat it, God had to provide an instance of one-upsmanship. And what did the Mateh Aharon do? It swallowed all of the others. But on the other hand, there's a nifty little side to that too. When God first displays the trick to Moshe, Moshe is frightened by it. Apparently Moshe didn't know that this was something that was an old conjurer's trick. So God tells Moshe, don't worry Moshe, pick up the snake. But he tells Moshe how to pick up the snake? By its tail. This was to defeat the notion that Moshe was just another conjurer. An ordinary conjurer would also be able to turn the snake into a stick, but only by picking it up on its head. Moshe was able to turn it into a stick by holding, by picking it up on its tail. But the snake too was venerated by the Egyptians. And if you have a picture in your mind's eye of that crown or helmet, but somewhat triangularly shaped crown or helmet which was worn by the kings of Egypt, you know that from the middle over the forehead they projected a snake. So that here too, nothing goes by that is just coincidental. Everything is deliberate, everything is purposeful, and the purpose and the intent of everything that goes on is to deliver a blow which will simultaneously accomplish the three purposes. That it will ultimately lead to the liberation of the Jews from their Egyptian bondage, that it will commend to Pharaoh the belief in the existence of God and the recognition that God operates vitally within the historical process, and will at the same time undermine the beliefs of the Egyptians in those objects of veneration or deification of their God. Let me get some sort of a sense of what it is that I find interesting in the stories of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Let's come to the material, to the sheets that I had distributed. If you didn't get one, then please we'll make a social evening out of this and introduce yourself to somebody who has and share them. What you have, one sheet, right, the manuscript, that is to say the one in my own handwriting, contains selections from two prakim of Tehillim. Tehillim Ayin Chet and Tehillim Kof Hei. And that's the one which I would like to address first. If our subject is ancient and modern interpretations of the Exodus, it's hard to get more ancient than the Bible itself. What we have here are two prakim of Tehillim, in which there are allusions or references to the plagues, which were the preludes to the Exodus from Egypt. And I'd like to go over them with you. And if you can keep in your, again, in your mind's eye a mental image of the ten plagues, let's check them off as we go through these two chapters of Tehillim, and let's see what kind of elaboration is provided in the text of Tehillim for these plagues. And we'll begin to see how we have already accepted some of them as part of our tradition. Let's start, just to do it in sequential order, we'll start with the text in Tehillim Ayin Chet. There in Pasuk Mem Gimel, in verse 43 of that psalm, we come to the beginning of the description of the plagues. Asher sam b'mitzrayim ototav, motetav, disedei tzoram. That God displayed his signs in Egypt, and he displayed his wonders in the plains of Tzohar. Here I pause just for a moment for a methodological point. And that is to remind those of you who know and to introduce to those of you who do not yet know the notion that the most striking and most salient feature of biblical poetry is its use of repetition. Repetition through the use of synonyms. The term which is used for it in modern scholarship is parallelism. The term which was used for it in medieval parshanot is derech hakeifa. So that the structure of an ordinary biblical poetic verse is such that it allows an idea to be iterated and then reiterated. But in order to keep it from being boring, when it is reiterated, it causes to use synonyms. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov,
Mishkanotecha Yisrael. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. Tents, dwelling places, are just two ways of expressing the notion of homes or domicile. Jacob and Israel are just simply two different ways of referring to that same patriarch, the eponymous ancestor of the Israelite people. Here too. In the first half of the verse, we have the word otot, signs, and that is complemented, paralleled in the second half of the verse by the word mofetach, wonders. In the first half of the verse, we have the formal name of Egypt, Mitzrayim, whereas in the second half of the verse, we have a less formal, more poetic rendition of the name of this culture or civilization, related, I suppose, to some particular geographical feature, the plains of Tzoan. By the way, the biblical name for Egypt is itself an indication of the degree of sophistication of biblical historians. Mitzrayim. That suffix, Mitzrayim, is the suffix that Hebrew generally reserves for pairs, for things that come naturally in pairs. Yadayim, Einayim, Oznayim, Raglayim. In fact, Hebrew reserves this grammatical form called the dual. It reserves it for parts of the body and for periods of time. Yomayim, Shruayim, Shnatayim. Whereas other Semitic languages, in fact, have a dual form for anything. Anything of which you can say one. In Arabic, there is a way of saying and Lower Egypt is in the north, because what matters is that Upper Egypt was that part of the country which was closest to the headwaters of the Nile, and Lower Egypt was the part of the country which was relatively distant from the headwaters of the Nile, and with all due deference to Sir Richard Burton and to others who have searched for the headwaters of the Nile, they appear to be in Lake Victoria in Uganda. Therefore, Southern Egypt was regarded as Upper Egypt. And originally, Upper and Lower Egypt were two completely separate countries. And it was only at some point in time, which is at a point which precedes even the patriarchal period, that these two countries were united. And therefore, the recognition on the part of biblical history to that unification of the two separate kingdoms is preserved in the unusual use of the dual form of Mitzrayim. Two mitzvahs. Okay, so this is an important feature, this feature of parallelism, of kathos, is an important one to know, because at times it's very useful. If we come across a verse in which the first half of the verse is a word that we don't understand, before we go running to our concordances and to our biblical dictionaries, we should just be patient for a moment and read the rest of the verse, because it's possible that while the first half of the verse uses an unusual form of the word, the parallel form in the second half of the verse may be a much more recognizable one. Now we start. Vayahapoch l'dam ye'orehem, that God turned the rivers of the Nile into blood, denotes lehem bal yishtayu, and he made all of their liquids, all of their waters, undrinkable. Okay? So we can check off the plague of now. Yishalach bahem arov vayochleim utzefardecha vatashchitem. That God inflicted upon them or sent amongst them arov, which devoured them, and tzefardecha, which destroyed them. There we go. Are these synonymous descriptions of the same plague? Or are these two separate plagues? Let's reserve decision on that for a moment, because if everything else works out fine, if by the time we conclude this page, we have references to all of the 10 plagues as we know them from the Torah, and the only problem is our own, then, Sephardea, so we can resolve that with little difficulty. If, however, by the time we finish this page, we will discover that not only do we not have all of the 10 plagues of Egypt, but even those which we do have do not appear in the same sequence in which they are narrated in the Torah, then that will give us much more latitude for discussion. So going on. Vayitein lechasil yivulam v'yigiam la'arveh. That God gave their yivul, their crops, over to something called chasil, and, synonymously, he gave their yigi'ah, that which they toiled over, that which they labored to produce, he turned it over to arveh, to the locusts, right? The first of the three plagues in this morning's sidra. Well, here there's no doubt, because we know hasil. Hasil is, in fact, a biblical synonym for arveh. But the biblical text which describes locusts in their greatest detail is from the book of Yoel, one of the Treasar, one of the so-called minor prophets. I'd like to meet the guy who was able to sit in judgment and decide when they were minor prophets. But so they are called. Let's give them the benefit of doubt and say that minor was not so much a judgment on their value as prophets as much as just a description of the relative size of these prophets. So the book of Yoel contains a prophecy of how the land of Israel is going to be devastated by a plague of locusts, and there appear all of the different names by which locusts were known. Clearly we've jumped out of sequence. Even before we resolve the question of whether Arov and Sephardea in the previous verse are two separate plagues or two synonymous references to the same plague, it's clear that once we go past Dam Sephardea, and we haven't encountered Kinim, Arov, well, Deber, Shochim, Barad, and we jump to Arveh, it's perfectly clear even at this moment that the author of Tehillim is clearly not trying to provide us with a poetic rendition of Sefer Shemot. He has, in fact, seemed to have availed himself of what we all know very well is called poetic license. That is to say, it's clear that if we had any expectation of discovering here the 10 plagues in the sequence in which we know them from Shemot, which is simply not a prose description but a parallel poetic description of them, then that's not what we're getting. What we're getting instead is a perspective on the plagues by a later biblical poet who is under no obligation to describe every plague, nor is he under any obligation to describe those plagues which he does deal with in their sequence, in the sequence in which they originally appeared in the Torah. Therefore he goes on, Yaharov babarav gafnam v'shikmotam bahanamah. That God killed their vines with hail or frost, and he killed their sycamore trees with, again, a form of frost. Vayasger matbarad de'iram, and he gave their beasts over to the hail, umiknehem la'reshafim, and he turned their cattle over to sparks. Now, on one hand, we recall that the Torah's description of the plague of Barad something very strange about Eish mitlakahat betoch abarat. That with if you could crack open one of these hailstones, you would discover at the center of the hailstone not a core of frozen ice, but rather the core of the hailstone was fire. Now, since Rishathib means sparks, Rishathib could in fact be a poetic synonym for Barad, providing, of course, that as the background, you knew the Torah. Meaning somebody who, when you said to him, Makat Barad, could say, aha, the Eish Mitlakachat B'tocha Barad, would understand how you're using the word Rishathib, sparks, as its poetic synonym. Obviously, anybody who does not have that association would think of Barad and Rishathib not as synonym, but quite properly as opposites, as antonyms. Now, that's all fine and good in terms of preserving the poetic structure of the verse. But how about the content? Didn't we just do the plague of Barad in Pasuk Mem Zayim? And was it not true that the Barad destroyed plant life? It destroyed trees in Egypt? What is this repetition of Barad in Pasuk Memchet with this strange reference to how the Barad not only destroyed vines and sycamore trees, but how the Barad endangered sheep and cattle? So you'd say that by implication, those animals which were left out of doors were killed by hailstones.
Right.
Very strange, that the hailstones would kill hale and hardy animals, but they wouldn't kill the chita and the sora, ki api lo pena.
Those animals were supposed to be out there for the moment, whereas the chita and the sora were not yet right for the man, and also the death that they were killed.
No, they weren't killed in the sense that, well, but why would hailstones kill animals?
Animals sometimes fly.
There are people who actually say this head is a parenthetical note. You know that in the Tochecha, God warns the Jewish people that if they continue to perform abominations, that he will punish them, not only with all manner of scriptural plagues, but he threatens them with Machala Shelo Samti B'Mitzrayim Asim Alecha, that he will strike them even with plagues which didn't even occur in Egypt. America is truly a fulfillment in many respects of a Mahalan Shalasanti from Israel. In any event, that indeed is a possibility. But I offer just for your consideration an additional possibility. Remembering again that we're dealing here with a poetic text whose author obviously took some poetic license. Reshef in Biblical Hebrew is a word which has more than one meaning. If you think of the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, which describes love as a torch, ki azach hamavet ahava kasha ki she'ol kina rishafeha rishpe'esh, right? That the sparks that are ignited by love or by jealousy can burn just like fire. But there's another resha in Pana. Pardon? He talks about B'nai Reshef, you have the B or O. But there it's not clear. It's not clear whether B'nai Reshef are little sparks, right? Or whether Reshef is a kind of burn. Right? The Parshanim are split on the question. Because Reshef, in addition to meaning sparks, is also used in Pana infrequently, it's true, but it is a poetic synonym for Deder. Reshef is a synonym for Deder, for the plague. How much imagination does it take to take the word Barad and metathesize it? Flip it around. Happens sometimes in Biblical Hebrew. Simla, Salma, Keves, Kesef. how much imagination does it take to see that what we have here could very well be a very, very nifty, sophisticated, a very, very nifty little poetic touch. Disguise the word dead there by using the same consonants, but inverting them, and then to make it all the more interesting, use a poetic synonym, reshef, which could mean either one. It could either be an allusion to the eshnit lakaha ditol habarad, or it could be reshef in the sense of that thing which accompanies the play. And now a pasuk which we know from the Haggadah, Yishalachtam haronamo, ayevra bazaam bitzara, mishlachat malachei ra'im. A general verb. There's no particular plague here. It says that God said against the Egyptians his burning anger, his wrath, his indignation, trouble, and, get this, a band of deadly messengers. Mishlachat, a band, right? An embassy of malachei ra'im, deadly messengers. Now, how do you say messengers in Hebrew? Malachim. How do you say deadly or evil messengers in Hebrew? Malachim Ra'im. How it says here. Now let's say you didn't want to say evil messengers using the noun Malachim and the adjectival form Ra'im. Let's say you wanted to make this a construct of two nouns. You wanted to say angels of evil. What would that be in Hebrew? Malachei Ra or Malachei Ra'ot. There is no Malachei Ra'ot. That's what it is. There's no word Ra'im in Hebrew. There's no noun Ra'im in Hebrew. It's an adjectival form. But if Ra'im is an adjective, then Malachei is wrong. It should be Malachim. Malachei is the semichot, the construct form of Malach. It means angels of. And you can't have angels of an adjective. You can only have angels of another noun. But Ra is in the singular, and the plural of Ra is not Ra'in. The plural of Ra is Ra'ot. Therefore, what we have here is an impossible form. If it were to say evil angels, it should be Malachim Ra'in. If it were to say angels of evil, then it would have to be Malachei Ra'ot. What we have here is an impossible form. Malachei Ra'im.
Messengers of evil people.
Pardon me?
The messengers of evil people.
But that's not it. They're messengers of God. So they're not messengers of evil people. They're messengers of God. Now, it's very, very interesting. And in relating to you this next word, this closes I'm going to come to discussing the historical background of the Exodus. Have you ever heard of Emanuel Velikovsky?
Yeah.
Sure, I'm not allowed. Members of the fan club? No, okay. Alright. Emanuel Velikovsky was a very, very significant, but more than significant, very controversial figure of about 40 years ago, who had a whole bunch of theories. I think his books appeared in the 1950s. Maybe took a long time to find the publisher. Okay. In any event, previous generation, who had a whole bunch of very strange theories. Theories about cosmology, theories about the origin of the universe, the origin of planets. And he wrote a whole bunch of books about them, which at the time started witch hunts. It's the best that I can tell you about it. I mean, he was castigated, excoriated, I mean, whatever names the scientific community could think of to call him, they called him, and they even made up some that, you know, steadily, ever since those books were published, as the nature of scientific knowledge has ostensibly been advanced, right, by the Hubble telescope and by all sorts of space exploration, it turns out that Emanuel Velikovsky knew what he was talking about. He couldn't document his theories because the scientific tools and instrumentation were not yet available, but it is descriptions of what has since come to be known in some cases as the asteroid theory and the planetary separation theory and things like that have been borne out by subsequent scientific research. One of the books that he read that I enjoy most, and I can really relate to all of the scientific things, is a book called The Earth's in Upheaval, Worlds in Collision. Those are the more controversial ones. It's a book about the Exodus, about the age of the Exodus, about the 10 plagues and the like, which is called Ages in Chaos. It's his attempt to try to offer a reconciliation between biblical and Egyptian chronology. And just one of the little things through the book that struck me that I remember is his interpretation of this verse. And he explains, as I've just explained to you, that the phrase Malachi Ra'im is an impossible construction in Hebrew. And therefore he says, if it's impossible, the only thing that we can do is emend it. That is to say, to assume that some sort of scribal error occurred in the transmission of the text, right? And to try to, with doing as little damage to the text as necessary, try to figure out what the mistake was and to correct it. Therefore what he does is he eliminates the letter Aleph from the word Malachi, leaving you with another perfectly good Hebrew word, Malachi, which means kings of. And then he vocalizes the letters Resh, Ayin, Yud, Mem as Ro'im, Malachi Ro'im, the kings of shepherds, which happens to be one of the few things that we know about an ethnic group called the Hyksos, who occupied and ruled Egypt from somewhere in the 19th century BCE until the 16th century BCE, who were, at least according to some reasonable reconstructions of ancient Egyptian and biblical chronology, the rulers of Egypt during the time of Joseph. That is to say, the pharaohs who were befriended by and became friends to the Israelites, and who, when the middle kingdom of Egypt, when the dynasty started up again by throwing the Hyksos out, took out their frustrations against the Hyksos by subjugating all of the people who had been friendly to the Hyksos, and that's the Vayakom el Hadash HaMitzrayim Asher Lo Yada Et Yosef. And think about it, just how brilliant even Ezra was, that without knowing about the Hyksos and without even having read Immanuel Velikovsky, he was able to say that what is a Melech Hadash? That not merely another king, but a new king of a new dynasty. That he understood intuitively that you can't just simply succeed the former king and say, who's Yosef? I never heard of him. But only if you represent a brand new dynasty, which is replacing a former dynasty, can you make such a claim. Therefore, his argument enabled him to link the story of the Exodus and the plagues to Egyptian history and chronology. Finally, Pasuk Nun, Yifales Nativ La'apol, Lo Hasach Mimavet Nafsham, that God cleared a path for his anger, he didn't even stop short of slaying them. Hayatam La'dever Hisgir, now we get the appropriate reference to Dever. Vayach Kol B'chor B'mitzrayim Reshit Olim B'aholecha. Truth is, if you go over this very carefully, you will discover that there are only seven plagues listed here. There is Dan, there is Tzifardea, there is Arod, Dever, Barad, Arbe, and Makat Bechorot. Three Makot are notable for their absence here, Kinim, Shechin, and Chosha. Without the time now to go through the other list, but it's just simply more of the same. If you flip the page and look at the list in Tehillim Kof Hei, you'll find that in Tehillim Kof Hei, there are once again seven or possibly eight plagues. The problematic one again is Arod. You know that traditionally Arod is described as what? Wild animal, right? You all know that because when you open your Haggadah of Pesach and you look at the little illustrations in the margin, so what is the illustration for Arov? Wild animals. Truth is that Arov just means a mixture. Arov, the word Arov simply signifies that this makah consisted of several different species. Who says that they were species of animals? It's quite likely that they were something else. Maybe they were species of harmful insects, disease-carrying flies, or the like. But the interesting thing is that when you compare both of the lists, the ones in Tehillim Ayin Chet and Tehillim Kol Hei, you discover that Shechin doesn't appear on anybody's list. Of all the ten Matot, nine of them appear in one or another of these two chapters of Tehillim. But the Makav Shechin, the boils, doesn't appear in either of them. Now, as I said when we got into this, the easiest explanation for this is to simply say that the author of Tehillim, or the authors of these Prakim and Tehillim, under no obligation per se to render a poetic version of the Torah line by line sequentially, but it's just simply their poetic perspective. Right? And therefore, they do not have to refer to all of the plagues, and they certainly don't have to refer to them in their sequential order. Therefore, there could have been seven, there could have been eight, there could have been nine. The only thing that would have been strange is if they would have invented a makah, which is not in the Torah, which fortunately they do not appear to have done. Nevertheless, it intrigued the medieval commentators who tried to deal with the question of whether there is some more objective explanation to why certain makot are included while certain other makot are excluded. And again, I just leave it open to you. If you're curious, you can look at the commentaries, particularly of Ibn Ezra and of Radak, to each of these two prakim, and you can discover their attempts to provide, as I said, somewhat of a more objective explanation. I want to take just a few minutes that remain to deal with the second page that you have, and to point out yet another very fascinating confluence of both an old, of the old and the new. What you hold are, on one hand, just a page with a comparison of the accounts of the plagues between Exodus and Psalm 78 and 105 that we've basically gone through now. But if you look at the other side of the page, the one which contains a table which is identified as the literary structure of the plague's narrative. And if you look at it, all of a sudden, you see things that weren't clear before. You notice that the plagues run in cycles. If you take the column called Forewarning, right, which simply asks, was Pharaoh apprised in advance of this plague or not? Notice that in every one of the three cycles, the first plague and the second plague carried a forewarning. The third one didn't. Blood and frogs, yes. Mice, no. Insects and pestilence, yes. Boils, no. Hail and locusts, yes. Darkness, no. Now, one item all by itself could just be coincidental. But if we look further, we see that there are corresponding elements which show that this is no coincidence. For example, if there was a forewarning, look at the time indication of the warning. When was Moshe instructed by God to approach Paro and to warn him? And again, in each series of Makot, the first warning is always in the warning. The second is non-specific, and of course, since in the third one there is no forewarning, there's no time of it. Now it begins to look a little more like a little more than a coincidence. And if we move now to the instruction formula, the precise language with which God instructs Moshe to forewarn Paro, it climaxes in the case of every one of the first plagues in a series. God says to Moshe, Hashkem baboker v'hityatzev lifnei Faro, early in the morning, and go station yourself before Pharaoh. Whereas in the case of the second makah in each series, God's instruction to Moshe, as it was, for example, with the makah of Arbeh, which began this morning's sidrah. What was this morning's sidrah? Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Bore Pharaoh. And then, of course, since the third makah in each series had no forewarning, there is no time indication, and of course, there is no formula for the instruction. There is also, while not perfectly symmetrical, there is also somewhat of a correspondence in terms of who is the agent who is instructed by God to perform that particular makah. So that in each, at least in terms of the first two series of makah, right, you get in the first series and in the third, it's the same agent, right? Whereas in the second one, it appears to be the same agent, at least God brings two, Moshe brings one. It's an attempt to establish that what, if you read through the narrative, just appears to be helter-skelter. When you take a step back from it, and you lay this like an overlay map on top of it, all of a sudden begins to bring all of these different and separate details into focus, and a pattern emerges. And of course, this again, this table comes from a contemporary work of biblical scholarship, we really need to go no further than the commentary of Rashbam, on Shemot Perek Zayin Pasuk Kavav, to discover that he already noticed it. And he says, Shnei Pamim Hayam Moshe Matre Paro B'Shnei Makot U'Bashlishi Bo Hayam Matre V'Chein Kol HaSeder. They too was able to fasten on this. But the thing that becomes most obvious when you look at this, or perhaps least obvious, depending upon whether you're looking for the forest or you're looking for the trees, is that what it shows clearly is that when Rabbi Yehuda Hayam Notein Bahem Simanim, just to conclude on the note of the Haggadah, as I began on the note of the Haggadah, that when Rabbi Yehuda assigned a mnemonic device for the makot, he wasn't assigning us a mnemonic device so that we should remember the names of the makot. There are, after all, only 10, and the names aren't particularly complicated. It's certainly much easier to remember something that has significance, like Dams, or De'akinim, than to try to remember something called Tetzah, which in and of itself is not significant, it has no meaning. But notice, that the Rabbi Yehuda attempted to provide a mnemonic device for the makot, he didn't divide them into five groups, he didn't divide them into two groups, he divided them into, effectively, three groups, and that the three groups into which Rabbi Yehuda divided the makot are precisely the ones to which the makot are divided according to this table. Mitzach, Adash, and Be'ach. The Gemara says that Nisan Nig'alu over Nisan Atidim Lehikael, that just as Nisan was once the month which saw the redemption of the Jewish people, may the month of Nisan see the redemption of the Jewish people once again, or perhaps if we are sufficiently meritorious, maybe we won't even have to wait until Nisan. Thank you very much.
Anybody has question relative to what Professor Stockhouse said. I just like to point out to him, because the three that are not mentioned in this one Ayin Chet are the three that there was no warning about. And that seems to be somewhat similar. We've been working closely on that. Anyway, questions? Anybody? Okay? Yep?
You focus frequently on the technicalities of the language. Do you relate which the word Mitzrayim itself to the word Meitzar?
You ask me as a true etymology or as a folk etymology?
As a
true etymology.
Meitzar usually means something that's strange. I mean, even today the population of Mitzrayim is a strange
The literal translation is a strait. S-T-R-A-I-T. From the notion that, as you say, that you're pressed in on both sides, which is why if we feel ourselves in a meitzar, then what does the psalmist urge us to do? Yes, kavrati ya, and if we are fortunate, the response is anani va merchab, right? The notion of merchab is the undoing of the meitzar. If you're asking whether Mitzrayim is on account of the fact that Egypt was compressed into a small strip of land on either side of the Nile River, as I said, I think that's certainly useful as a folk etymology. But I really don't know whether that is a true etymology, because I don't know whether the word Mitzrayim is a Hebrew word or whether the word Mitzrayim is applying a Hebrew dual suffix to what is effectively an Egyptian word. There are many words in the Torah which are used in this context that we just don't know whether they are Hebrew or Egyptian. Just take Moshe for an illustration. Moshe is, like Mitzrayim, a word which can be interpreted Hebraically, but just as easily can be interpreted through Egyptian. It can be either Miramayim Mishitihu, or it can be the Egyptian substantive Moshe or Moseh, which we find as part of the names of many of the pharaohs of Egypt, which simply means the son of. Ramesses is the Meses or Moshe of Ra, the son of the god Ra. Tutmos or Tutmosis is the Moshe, the son of the god Tut. So when you have such a close correspondence between a Hebrew word and an Egyptian word, then it's really difficult to tell whether you have a true etymology or a folk etymology.
Would the same apply to words like ochum, aleph hedbah, which means, I think, field or something?
I don't know.
How about words like tohu and bohu, tohu gohu? Are they foreign in any way?
The quickest way to find that out is to either look in a biblical Hebrew dictionary or to look in the notes to the translation to Aryeh Kaplan's Living Torah. Because one of the things that he researched thoroughly were all different Semitic languages. And if there is such a reasonable explanation, he provides it. Again, I don't know those instances, but just give one other illustration. Vayikra havro liyosef sofna pa'aneh. Now that has given us in Hebrew a very delightful word, lefa'aneach, which in contemporary Hebrew means like to crack a code. And considering that the word sofnat resonates like the word tzafon, coming back to the same there, so you say, ah, sofnat are hidden things, and therefore sofnat, pa'aneach, is the one who reveals or decodes cryptic things. But if you take the sounds which make up Tzofnat Pa'aneach, and you transfer them into Egyptian, then it comes out to be Tzapa Anch'at, which means the god Anch speaks and he hears, which is quite likely what an Egyptian might have said to somebody who seemed to have, you know, to hear a voice of the god. So again, wherever there is such a correspondence between Hebrew words and actual words in other languages, it's difficult to tell. Yes? Call it figurative, and I'll agree with you. I'm not sure that everything that's not literal is necessarily allegorical. It could be metaphorical, it could just simply be figurative. Yes. I subscribe wholeheartedly to the notion that the Torah is written in such a way that I'm making considerations of time. I believe that is the notion of Mivuashimitz Rakhala Dorot Nikhtavah Shalomitz Rakhala Dorot Moga. If you subscribe to the notion that things are written in Tanakh not only because they have antiquarian interest, but because they have contemporary interest, then it means that we are encouraged to look at everything in Tanakh on two levels. What did it mean to the people to whom it was originally said? And simultaneously, what does it mean to us? therefore I can look at it through the eye of historical philology and say, well, since the people who came out of Egypt ostensibly knew Egyptian, therefore when they heard the words of Nachmanayah, they associated it with the name of Yosef in Egyptian. But since we don't know Egyptian, but we're supposed to make something out of the name of Nachmanayah, in spite of the fact that we don't know what it originally meant in Egyptian, so we play around with the Hebrew sounds and we come up with Nachmanayah Sifuna. So I don't know if everything is necessarily an allegory, but I do in fact believe that very often the Torah and the Nevi'im and the Ketuvim must be understood simultaneously on two levels. One, more or less Peshat, if for Peshat you will substitute consistent with the rules of historical philology, and simultaneously Birash, if by Birash you will just allow for a not necessarily literal interpretation.
Working in a different way.